from the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Welcome to the Friday edition of Washington Watch. I'm your host, Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this, the 17th of April, 2020. Hey, if you're listening to us right now on the Stand Firm app, make sure that you have the most updated version. It's been completely rebuilt from the bottom up. And if you don't have the app already, go to the Google Play Store or the Apple Store and search Stand Firm, or follow the link we've got online at our podcast website. You know the title. TonyPerkins.com. Coming up today on our show, who's to say what a life is worth? Well, the Department of Health and Human Services has stressed that it's a question best left to the author of life himself. While the coronavirus pandemic has placed a heartbreaking limit on the supplies necessary to provide life-giving care, hospitals in some states have been playing God with their dwindling resources, determining that the old or disabled ought to be relegated to palliative care instead of receiving ventilators and other necessary supplies. Now, we reported on some of these cases earlier this month on April 3rd, and I'm actually very happy to welcome back Roger Severino, Director of the Office for Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, on the resolution of some of these discrimination complaints against state health care systems. David Clausen, our Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview, will also join me in that segment to wrap up with his thoughts on the beliefs that inform policies like these. In my second block, I'll talk to FRC President Tony Perkins, who's had a very busy day. Earlier, Tony hosted a call with the Secretary of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf, and a national group of pastors. And Tony will be joining me within minutes of his phone call with President Trump, in which the president discussed the plan to reopen America. In the C block of today's show, I'll be joined by Jennifer Bryson, who's visiting fellow at the Hudson Institute, about her recent op-ed on the CDC playing sexual politics during a pandemic, as well as the opportunism of some on the left during a crisis in states like Virginia. And in the last block of today's show, we've got developments both foreign and domestic in the field of religious liberty. Catherine Beck Johnson, FRC's Research Fellow for Legal and Policy Studies, will join me to discuss FRC's newest resource, Restriction on Religious Liberty During the Coronavirus Crisis. And I'll be joined by Leila Gilbert, FRC's Senior Fellow for International Religious Freedom, about religious persecution abroad, even as Kurdish Muslims and Nigerian Christians fight an unseen enemy. As a reminder, follow us on Twitter at FRCDC, Tony Perkins at T Perkins, or me at Sarah P. Perry. And again, you can find our podcast on any one of your favorite podcast platforms. Well, the U.S. is approaching 700,000 confirmed coronavirus cases. Now, that means hospitals need a lot of extra medical equipment. And in certain states, medical professionals have opted to withhold treatment from the disabled and elderly based on their quality of life assessments. But the Office of Civil Rights at the Department of Health and Human Services is snuffing out these practices of rationing medical supplies one state at a time. And joining me now to talk about it is Director of the Office for Civil Rights at HHS, Roger Severino. Roger, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Glad to be back.
So we talked earlier this month on April 3rd about the fact that some of these states had found themselves the brunt of complaints about discriminatory treatment, and for good reason. But I'm joining now in this discussion, as we followed along with you, that we've got good news for two cases in particular, Alabama and Pennsylvania. So talk to me a little bit about the resolution of those complaints.
Yes, the issue is about triaging, particularly with the question of ventilators. If, God forbid, we reach a situation where tough calls have to be made, our first responders and our medical professionals need the guidance, the guardrails in place to make sure that discrimination never enters into the calculation, that stereotypes about people with disabilities, about people with older Americans, are not used, and, in fact, the decision is based only on objective medical evidence. What we want to avoid is any relative gauging of one life versus another based on who might be more worthy to live, who might be more useful. These sort of utilitarian calculuses that some ideas have been floating around, they have no place under our system of equal rights under law. We're all created equal, and that principle of equality is foundational. The state of Alabama, unfortunately, had a provision that singled out, quote-unquote, persons with severe mental retardation to be disqualified for these emergency services in a triage circumstance. I believe they recognized the error of having such a blatant exclusionary criteria, and they took it down. We intervened. They took it down and have made clear that they will be in full compliance with the law. They have a replacement policy that doesn't have discriminatory provisions and make sure that people are protected so there are no blunt age cutoffs either. Similarly, Pennsylvania also had some problematic provisions in their crisis standards of care, their triage policies. And in that case, they took into account particular disabilities as a way of deprioritizing people. And they also had long-range life expectancy taken into account and weighed. And when you get into those sorts of judgments, you're opening the door to discrimination based on a person's disability or their age in ways that cross the line. And we want to make sure, and we're happy to see, that the state of Pennsylvania, as with Alabama, acted within days to fix the problem, to take policies down that are improper and put policies that are within their discretion that they can do. They could set priorities, but they have to do it that respects the inherent human dignity of every single person.
You know, I was surprised at how quickly these two particular claims were resolved. And I have to say, on further thought, really, this is such a matter of life and death. And good on both of the administrations there for recognizing the fact that they were in complete error in this circumstance. Now, I know there are still other states that have discriminatory guidelines in consequence of how they deal with a pandemic and the potential shortage of emergency supplies and services. Do you hope that the resolution of these two complaints in favor of federal law will serve as a warning to other states that might not have cleaned up their books yet?
I very much hope it does, because the time is now to review your policies to make sure they're in compliance with civil rights laws. We are hopeful, given the president's unprecedented action under the Defense Production Act to increase the supply of ventilators. We're very hopeful that this question may not have to be faced. But if, in a worst-case scenario, it does happen, it has to be within the bounds of civil rights law. So states should take notice and look at their laws, look at their guidance, before they get a knock on the door from us. We're there to help them come into compliance. And we want to see things fixed before the problem has to ever be put into effect. Now, my sister is an ER nurse. I have two parents who are approaching 80 with underlying health conditions. I have a father-in-law who almost died from COVID-19 just a few days ago, and he recovered poignantly on Easter Sunday. That's when the tide was turned. So, you know, praise God, he's doing much better now. I would not want him or others or my parents to somehow be automatically put at the end of the line. And I also don't want my sister to be put in this terrible position of having to make these judgment calls without clear guidance that's within the law, because it's not fair to our first responders, our medical professionals, or people who may be suffering from these illnesses.
I have one last question for you, Roger. When you resolve these suits, these complaints against the cases, what is that process like? Are you finding yourself up against individuals and administrations who are shocked that these regulations, these guidelines are actually in place? Or do you think this is a situation in which they feel as though they are making a good choice in a tough situation?
Well, there's all sorts of different philosophies out there. And we want to make sure that whatever policy choices are made by the state, that it complies with the law within those guardrails. This is an issue where it's a reflection of our culture. How we respond to the least among us will be a testament to our national character. And part of that character is embodied in our civil rights laws, that we leave nobody behind, that we take account of the most vulnerable, those who with disabilities or older Americans. And those are the principles that should be guiding all the states that put these policies in place. And we're very happy with how the states have responded very quickly. And there are some good models out there in New York. They have an advisory council that issued very good guidance on how to do these plans. Arizona has some good plans as well. So there are resources out there for the states that they could latch onto to say, hey, these are good practices. Within their discretion, we just say you have to respect these certain lines that cannot be crossed where you separate the fit, quote unquote, from the unfit. That's a line that I don't think the American people would accept.
Yes. Roger Severino, Director of the Office for Civil Rights at HHS, has been my guest. I'm going to pivot quickly now to David Clausen, who is our Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview. David, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me, Sarah.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the Bible's statements and its clarity on the issue of utilitarianism, what it means to take the value of one life above another. I think the Bible is pretty clear on this prospect, isn't it?
Absolutely. The Bible is absolutely clear about the inherent dignity, value, and worth of every human being. And I just want to quickly say, Sarah, you know, listening to you talk to Roger Severino, who's the director of the Office for Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, what a blessing to have someone leading that office during this time who just so eloquently spoke about, he's talking about the value that all people have, and as Christians, my goodness, that really resonates with us. So, you know, what a blessing to have someone at a high level of government who is thinking along these lines.
Yes, absolutely. And we know, based on what we've seen in the research, $490 million contract was just signed by GM to make 30,000 ventilators by the end of August. We know that doctors are forced to be ingenuous with their use of particular machinery. Some are using BiPAP machines or CPAP machines. Some are using dryer hoods. So thank God there is no shortage. Yet we find ourselves going, well, that notion of rationing and that notion of not trusting enough, having to grab everything that you can. The Bible is pretty clear about that.
Absolutely. The Bible speaks very clearly. One of the most fundamental principles in Christian ethics is that human beings, all human beings, regardless of age, race, disability, are made in the image of God. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the Bible's clear on that. Now, when you get into questions about rationing, when there's a real limited supply and an overwhelming demand, you know, that's a difficult, tragic situation, which requires a lot of prayer, wisdom, and discernment. But I think the guidance that HHS has put out is a great starting point when doctors and nurses and medical professionals are having to make these decisions.
So we've got about a minute left here. What do you say to a doctor who thinks they are making the appropriate choice in choosing for one individual who potentially has a higher quality of life? What do you say to them?
I said that can't be the criteria that we're using. Maybe we need to prioritize those with profound needs most likely to survive, but we can't make a determination based on something subjective like disability, age, or race.
When we stand in God's shoes, we are bound to make the wrong decisions. David Clausen, love talking to you. Thank you so much for joining me today on Washington Watch. Well, coming up next after this, we'll hear from FRC President Tony Perkins as he shared details on his latest calls, one with the Secretary of Homeland Security and one with the president himself on the plan to reopen America. We'll be right back after this on Washington Watch.
Is historic masculinity lost forever? Where can boys, young men, husbands, and fathers find a model of manhood, leadership, and strength in a culture of gender confusion? We need men to be men, tough with compassionate strength, bent toward justice without compromise, locking arms and standing. We need to be the men God created us to be and fight for all that is right, true, and just. This is Tony Perkins inviting you to join us at a Stand Courageous Men's Conference. To find out more, go to standcourageous.com. This conference is led by men who are seasoned, compassionate men who understand the issues of the day and will invest in you, helping you understand your role as a defender, a provider, an instructor, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, so that you can have the generational influence that God has designed you to have. Learn more at standcourageous.com. That's standcourageous.com.
Did you know that Planned Parenthood is the primary supplier of abortions in the U.S.? According to Planned Parenthood's most recent annual report, it committed over 345,000 abortions in fiscal year 2018. That means, on average, Planned Parenthood aborted 1,768 babies every single day in 2018. And while Planned Parenthood's report revealed an increase in abortions committed, many of the services they provide, such as breast exams and cancer screenings, have drastically decreased. FRC recently released its 2020 edition of The Real Planned Parenthood, Leading the Culture of Death. In this resource, you will find many facts revealing the truth, that Planned Parenthood is in the business of abortion, not healthcare. To access this resource and to find out more, go to frc.org/Planned Parenthood Facts. That's frc.org/Planned Parenthood Facts.
We can all benefit from a good lecture. They inform you and grow you. But sometimes you can't make it in person to every talk, seminar, or lecture you'd like to. Fortunately, Family Research Council now has a new podcast so you won't miss out. FRC's new weekly podcast called Lecture Me was created to help inform and equip listeners on the biggest issues affecting our culture today. Each episode presents a lecture selected from the archives of the FRC Speaker Series. Our podcast features today's top thinkers who address important issues like religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture, all from a biblical worldview. Make sure to stay tuned after each lecture to hear FRC's thoughts on the content as they further discuss the topic at hand. The Lecture Me podcast is available wherever podcasts are found, or visit frc.org/podcasts.
Well, there's lots to discuss with my next guest, who is FRC's president, and he's the longest-serving president here at Family Research Council. He is also the host of the program you're listening to right now, Washington Watch. I'm joined now by Tony Perkins, who has had two very big calls today, one with the Secretary of Homeland Security and one with the president, both about the plan to reopen America. Tony, welcome to your show.
Well, it's good to be on the show, Sarah. Thanks so much for hosting on this Friday afternoon.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk first about your phone call with the Secretary of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf. You were joined by a number of pastors as well. So talk a little bit about what you all covered on that phone call.
Well, we've been doing a series of calls, Sarah, with pastors in our network. We've got about 15,000 pastors in our network across the country. And so we've, since all of this broke, we've been doing weekly calls. We've had actually a call with the president, the vice president, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo last week, actually joined the pastors. We've had Dr. Ben Carson and, of course, a number of members of Congress as well, just to kind of keep the pastors up to date with the latest, because pastors are influencers. A lot of people in their congregations look to them, and in an age of fake news where there's so much out there, this is something we do here in Washington Watch. We try to bring the news makers directly to the people so that they can hear exactly what's happening, unfiltered by these leftist lenses that are out there in the mainstream media. So what we're trying to do with the pastors is very similar, just taking them directly to the news, to the leaders of our country, so that they can hear directly what's happening and then relate that to their congregations. And so today we had Secretary of Homeland Security, as you said, Chad Wolf, talking about a couple of things. One, as you mentioned last night, the president rolling out the restart of America's economy and more broadly, just society as a whole. But we're also talking about the key role that the clergy plays in crisis situations like we're presently facing with the COVID-19. We had worked with the administration, Homeland Security, to get pastors, clergy, identified as essential service providers so that they could move around freely during crisis situations, because we've had some of our pastors in some states have been restricted in their ability to even go to their church buildings to record their messages.
Yes.
Since they can't meet. We've had pastors not, you know, a lot of them not able to go to the hospitals to care for dying members of their congregations. A recognition, just as in the military, you know, chaplains are on the front lines because they're essential. The spiritual nature of the human being says that spiritual counsel, especially in times of great danger, is significant. It's essential. It's needed. So we're grateful that we have an administration that reflects that in their policies. And so, in fact, today I'm just encouraging the president to drive that message home with governors as well, because while the administration has taken that position at the federal level, not all the states have.
Yes, that's the truth. And when you talk to the president today, we know that in public he has spoken to the press about the fact that this is a phase in a reopening of America, but he is going to leave a lot of the individual decision making to the governors themselves. So what did he say when he was talking to you today?
Well, the president was talking about the phased plan. He is very eager to get the economy going again, and the faith leaders that were on the call clearly understand that and support the president in the efforts that he's taken. But again, there's a lot to be said about how this administration is mindful of and supportive of the Christian community. Mm-hmm. You know, we had last week, you know, actually, I guess it was this week, on our program, at the Department of Justice, Eric Dryband, who was talking about how the DOJ intervened in Mississippi, and that case there were filed a letter of interest there because of the church that was prohibited from having a drive-in service. So the administration's very mindful that churches are working to stay within the CDC guidelines and be a part of the solution and not the problem. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they realize they have a mission too, and they want the churches to be able to pursue their mission and not to be hindered by hostile elected officials in certain parts of the country. So expect this administration to continue to champion religious freedom, even in the midst of crisis situations.
And encouraging to know that this is a president who really has struck the appropriate balance, as much as one can strike the appropriate balance, between being supportive of the economy and also recognizing that this is a health pandemic, that it's affected every state and multiple countries, and that he really has to make these tough decisions. But he is surrounded by great people who support him and his commitment to protecting the faith and the exercise of the faith of the multiple leaders, the pastors, the deacons, the individuals who are leading their faith community, shepherding them, is really encouraging to me, who is myself a member of a flock. So he's leaving a lot of this power to the states. Do you anticipate that that'll be a paradigm that works for the country?
Well, I think it is, because we know that a one size does not fit all. And I think in most of the states, you know, the only place I'm really concerned about is the Northeast, where you have more Democratic governors, and I guess the West Coast as well, that, you know, they never let a crisis go unseized in terms of trying to pursue other initiatives such as the mail-in ballots and trampling, like we saw in, it was surprising, it was in Mississippi, but where they were trampling on religious freedom there. You know, what is so fascinating about this, Sarah, is this president, you know, coming in right before this crisis, I mean, the thing that he talked about most, and the thing not for all of us, but most characteristic about his administration, was the low job unemployment rates and the booming economy. And so this is really a struggle for him to balance this, but it shows you that he is putting America first.
He certainly is. Tony Perkins, always great to talk to you. Thank you for what you're adding to the conversation nationally and here at home in D.C. Well, coming up next after this, we've got sexual politics being played by the Centers for Disease Control through their online monitoring tool. And we've got Governor Northam in Virginia, who just can't seem to get enough of opening bathroom doors to everyone. We'll be right back with Jennifer Bryson after this on Washington Watch.
What are you reading this spring? At FRCblog.com, we have timely and original commentary on the issues facing our culture today. Our blog is written by our policy experts, the Family Research Council team, and outside contributors. On our blog, you can read about a wide variety of topics, including religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture. Some of our most recent blog posts include, "To abandon the nuclear family ideal is to abandon being human." "Why does the abortion industry hate women?" "China uses coronavirus to oppress religious minorities." And many more. At Family Research Council, our mission is to advance faith, family, and freedom in the culture by helping you to live out your faith and to stand for truth. With our blog, we hope to help you do that. Stay informed and get the resources you need at FRCblog.com. Again, that's FRCblog.com.
The Fairness for All Act was recently introduced to the House of Representatives after the passage of the Equality Act. In response, FRC has come out with a new publication, The Unfairness of the Fairness for All Act. This act attempts to find a compromise between the First Amendment protection of religious freedom and the demands of the LGBT community. Despite having the best intentions, it is an ill-advised and poorly drafted bill that does not achieve its goal. If this act is passed into law, it would allow the federal government to impose a belief system and ideology about sexual behavior and identity on all Americans. The Fairness for All Act would negatively impact religious freedom, true equality, and the privacy and safety of women. To access this resource and to learn more, go to frc.org/fairnessforall. That's frc.org/fairnessforall.
Welcome back to Washington Watch on this Friday afternoon. I'm your host, Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships. I'm sitting in for Tony Perkins. TonyPerkins.com is our podcast website. Follow Tony on Twitter at TPerkins or me at Sarah P. Perry. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about sexual politics. Yes, in this instance, it is relative to COVID-19. The CDC's online coronavirus self-checker asks about gender with the options of male and female, but also adds other as a category. The CDC is accommodating the LGBTQ community, but here's the thing. Sex matters when it comes to the coronavirus. Joining me now to talk about it, and fresh off her op-ed, American Greatness, is visiting fellow at the Hudson Institute, Jennifer Bryson. Jennifer, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks for the opportunity to talk with you.
So, Jennifer, we know that there has been another option added to the online checker. This is a resource for individuals who think they may have COVID-19. But here's the problem. It is sex specific. There are particular functions of this disease that seem to favor, that seem to affect one sex over the other, aren't there?
Yes, and there's still a lot we don't know, but research emerging in multiple countries is showing the same thing again and again. As the Los Angeles Times reported, studies out of Italy, Korea, and China have been showing that there are more men who are severely impacted by this, and also men seem to be more likely to die. So this is serious.
And yet, with an option on the CDC site that says other, we're presented with a little bit of a problem because there is no distinguishing, there is no discrimination of COVID-19 based on an other sex or an other gender. It is simply male and female. So is there, for example, an exception for somebody who is intersex, perhaps? And I'm playing devil's advocate here.
So as I explained in my article, citing the excellent book I recommend to your listeners by Ryan Anderson called When Harry Met Sally, that intersex, that phrase that we use, is not a third category of sex. It refers rather to anomalies and disformities in the sexual organs of the body, and in most cases, the individuals, their chromosomes are male or female, that, and also it's a very small portion of the population. And so that is not the reason for this other category. And it's telling that this CDC coronavirus self-checker lists this question as gender, this vague word that has become so confusing, mm-hmm. when in fact they should ask for sex, male or female.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, for people who are not English speaking, as you also mentioned in your article, you're putting them to a sort of difficult understanding of making sense of an other category for sex, because there's not going to be a translation or understanding there. And if the CDC wants to effectively reach all non-English speakers in the country, they've really gone out of their way to make it difficult. Now, in the couple minutes we have left, I want to talk a little bit about Governor Northam, who can't seem to keep himself out of the news. And while the rest of us were celebrating Good Friday and dealing with the effects of the coronavirus pandemic, whether that's a loss of jobs or the inability to find something as simple as milk, he quietly signed into law a bill that forces public businesses and even private organizations to open women's bathrooms, locker rooms, showers, and dressing rooms to biological men who identify as women. So this particular law has a very narrow cutout for religious organizations, but appears to read that if that religious organization, for example, like a Christian school that sponsored a football or basketball game, would actually be required by the state to allow adult men who say they are trans and therefore women to use women's restrooms. Is this more of the political profiteering of the left? And has Governor Northam really gone out of his way to make a political point when the rest of us are focused on coronavirus?
It's astonishing he would do this at this time, I think in particular on Good Friday. And yes, this new law in Virginia is related. It's part of this confusion of using this vague language of gender when, in fact, our society has human beings. Human beings are mammals, and mammals are male and female. Mm-hmm.
Yes, indeed. And to quote Justice Kennedy when he wrote the concurrence in NIFLA, as many of us know because we've read and followed this case, it's not forward-thinking to force individuals to be an instrument for fostering public adherence to an ideological point of view they find unacceptable. So the new law that Northam has just signed into being punishes people for not assenting to an anti-Christian, anti-woman view of the human person. It's not forward thinking. And it's devastating to women and offensive to the notion of biblical manhood and womanhood. Well, coming up in my last block today on Washington Watch, we're going to talk religious persecution. And indeed, the coronavirus is affecting even that. We'll talk to FRC's research fellow, Catherine Beck Johnson, and FRC's senior fellow for international religious freedom, Leela Gilbert, on Washington Watch right after this.
Where can young men, husbands, and fathers find a model of real manhood, leadership, and strength in today's culture of gender confusion? This is Tony Perkins inviting you to join us at a Stand Courageous Men's Conference led by men who are seasoned, compassionate men who understand the issues of the day and will help you understand your role as a defender, provider, instructor, battle buddy, and chaplain so that you can have the generational influence God has designed you to have. Learn more at StandCourageous.com.
Recently, a bill called the Fairness for All Act was introduced to the House of Representatives. In response, FRC has a new resource, the Unfairness of the Fairness for All Act. This act attempts to find a compromise between the First Amendment's protection of religious freedom and the demands of the LGBT community. But, unfortunately, it is a poorly drafted bill that would negatively impact religious freedom, true equality, and the privacy and safety of women. Learn more at frc.org/fairnessforall.
Did you know that Planned Parenthood is the primary supplier of abortions in the U.S.? According to Planned Parenthood's most recent annual report, it committed over 345,000 abortions in fiscal year 2018. That means, on average, Planned Parenthood aborted 1,768 babies every single day in 2018. And while Planned Parenthood's report revealed an increase in abortions committed, many of the services they provide, such as breast exams and cancer screenings, have drastically decreased. FRC recently released its 2020 edition of The Real Planned Parenthood, Leading the Culture of Death. In this resource, you will find many facts revealing the truth, that Planned Parenthood is in the business of abortion, not healthcare. To access this resource and to find out more, go to frc.org/Planned Parenthood Facts. That's frc.org/Planned Parenthood Facts.
We can all benefit from a good lecture. They inform you and grow you. But sometimes you can't make it in person to every talk, seminar, or lecture you'd like to. Fortunately, Family Research Council now has a new podcast, so you won't miss out. FRC's new weekly podcast, called Lecture Me, was created to help inform and equip listeners on the biggest issues affecting our culture today. Each episode presents a lecture selected from the archives of the FRC Speaker Series. Our podcast features today's top thinkers who address important issues like religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture, all from a biblical worldview. Make sure to stay tuned after each lecture to hear FRC's thoughts on the content as they further discuss the topic at hand. The Lecture Me podcast is available wherever podcasts are found, or visit frc.org/podcasts.
Welcome back to Washington Watch on this Friday afternoon, April 17th. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. TonyPerkins.com, our podcast website. Follow us on all of your favorite platforms for podcasts. And be sure to download the most updated version of the Stand Firm app, available in the Google Play Store and the Apple Store. Well, coronavirus has affected, as we've talked about, just about every aspect of American life. And there are some particularly heavy-handed states that have gone too far in restricting the free exercise of religion during the pandemic. Joining me now to talk about it domestically is FRC's Research Fellow for Legal and Policy Studies, Catherine Beck Johnson. Catherine, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me, Sarah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what these guidelines, social distancing guidelines, stay-at-home orders, how the prevention, the intended prevention of the spread of coronavirus is actually taking a pretty heavy toll on worshipers in some states.
That's right. Over 40 states have issued stay-at-home orders, so this is restricting how Americans can go about all aspects of their daily lives. And that includes worshiping. So a lot of states have allowed for religious exemptions, but there's still a lot of states that are refusing to exempt any sort of religious activity for worshipers.
So what are some of the most compellingly, Orwellian? Yes, Orwellian decisions. We know, for example, in Mississippi, originally drive-in church service goers were told that they couldn't worship, and then thankfully the mayor reversed course. But we've got sort of a catalog of uglies of a number of different states that have all been impacted by these particular decisions. So give me a sense of some of those.
Yeah, I would say definitely the most concerning is not allowing drive-through services. So this also happened in Louisville. The mayor announced during Holy Week that there would be no Easter drive-through services, yet the city of Louisville was allowing people to attend drive-through liquor stores or drive-through restaurants. Mm-hmm. And so this showed a clear targeting of religious services. And then as people are going to these drive-through services, clearly socially distanced from other people in their cars, unable to get the virus, they are being issued tickets. And so that was definitely something concerning to see, as people were taking these guidelines seriously and staying in their cars and attempting to work with the government and still worship, yet they were being ticketed by the government authorities.
Now, we have got a new publication out specifically designed to address these issues, religious restrictions on religious freedom during the coronavirus crisis, a new issue brief. Tell me a little bit about that issue brief and what some of the things are that the staff here at FRC were thinking about addressing when we wrote it.
So yeah, a group of us worked together to put out this issue brief, and we wanted to go through what different exemptions various states have instituted. So, for example, 12 states designated places of worship as essential services, 5 states deemed traveling to religious places of worship as essential. So we kind of ran through the various religious exemptions that we were seeing. And then we also wanted to make note of what the law was concerning how religious liberty and free exercise plays into a time like this with the government interests of a pandemic. And then we also addressed what are some of the current cases going on. You know, different various law groups, legal groups are suing state officials. So we ran through what some of the legal opinions were. And this is a resource. It's on frc.org/church. It's designated as a top resource under church resources if people would like to view it as well.
Catherine, thanks so much for joining me today. I'm going to pivot now and present more of an international context for how the coronavirus is working to restrict the religious liberty of worshipers abroad. And we're going to talk specifically about people groups in Nigeria and also some Kurdish Muslims. So to do that with me today is FRC Senior Fellow for International Religious Freedom, who is a multi-published author on the issue of religious liberty, Lila Gilbert. Lila, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hi, Sarah. It's nice to talk to you again.
So glad to have you on. We need to think above and beyond the restrictions within our own country, because while we languish with our Netflix and our air-conditioned units and our pets and our family members and a stock refrigerator, there are individuals in less developed countries who are having to fight not only the unseen enemy of a health pandemic, but also infringement and, in many cases, outright human rights abuses on their religious and ethnic identity. So let's start with Nigeria, for example. Can you give us and the listeners a little bit of a sense of what's going on there?
Nigeria is a bloodbath, to put it very bluntly. It's a disaster for Christian believers for several reasons, but the main reasons are two different groups of terrorists that are attacking them, virus or no virus. There are thousands of dead in Nigeria, and I've seen numbers as high as 30,000 plus just since 2015. I don't know that we can, it's very hard to verify because so many of these reports are right off the ground by people that survived a massacre. But the truth is, between Boko Haram, which we sort of know the name of here because of the girls that were kidnapped,
yes,
and Michelle Obama's involvement in that. But there's another group called the Fulani tribe, and we're calling them Fulani terrorists because they are going into Christian communities, slaughtering people, burning people, and seizing land. And there are many, many IDPs, in other words, refugees, that have no place to go after this happens. Thousands. We've had 3 reports in the last week of these attacks.
Wow.
They're in the center of Nigeria, in the center states of Nigeria. The Boko Haram tend to attack more in the northeast of Nigeria, but I mean, none of us have a map of Nigeria in our heads, right?
Right.
So it's hard for people to realize this is going on, along with shutdowns on the for the virus. And so people, the Christians, are just beyond traumatized by what's going on there.
Well, and on top of having to fight terrorist infiltrations and the threat of their very lives at stake every day, there are less resources to be able to police these environments, and there is less governmental help available because, as it is in the United States, what is normally available is currently on pause. So they really find themselves up against a wall and having to fight this issue on their own. You also have written recently about the Syrians, and they too are really the subject of an urgent appeal that was sent to Director General of the World Health Organization because they're pleading for test kits to detect coronavirus infections, but they're facing increasingly horrific circumstances. Talk a little bit about that.
Northeast Nigeria has been in a terrible place where, since the war began, since the civil war began, and Syria has been the longest term fighting in that because of various forces, including Russia and Turkey. And the Christian communities and the Kurdish communities along that border have been the last bastion of attacks, it seems. Everything else looks like it's settled down. But I've been hearing about this abuse in this area for months. And what's happened is the Turks came in at sort of the invitation of the president, although I don't think he meant to send an invitation. But when he said that American troops were withdrawing from that particular area, Turkey just was in there like in a heartbeat.
Right.
And so we have a huge number of refugees there. We have Christians and Kurds that have been kicked out of their homes. Refugees have moved in. I think Turkey's idea or Erdogan's idea was to move in some of the refugees that had gone into Turkey and to get them out of Turkey and into Syria again. But he was taking other people's homes to do that. So my bottom line with the article I wrote was that because of the virus, there were no test kits. And Bassam, who made this request, when I looked into it with people in Israel who are dealing with medication for that area and trying to get it in, there are no test kits for that area. There are no test kits available. So we have refugees living, many of them, in actual camps. No, and the Turks have cut off the water supply to some parts of this area, so they can't even wash their hands, much less prevent this pandemic. So it's a nightmare, and it hasn't even hit yet, really, as hard as it will. So, you know, again, it's man's inhumanity to man, but it's something that there are many of our Christian brothers and sisters in there. There are many victimized Kurds, and there are others, Arabs and others, that are trapped in this place. And so that's why I was really touched by Bassam's request for test kits, but then I found out there aren't any.
Yes, which is so heartbreaking. Again, not only are you having to fight the onslaught on all sides, you're having to fight an unseen enemy in a viral pandemic with no test kits, no running water, no sanitation, no ability to prevent the spread of the virus. So you're really, again, hemmed in on all sides, which makes a heartbreaking plea, I think, for the individuals who listen to this program to not forget those who are persecuted in a time like this. So I would love to hear from you. While the rest of us are prioritizing the notions of, and rightly so, our family's health and safety, if we have enough food, but we are in a free society, the freest nation in the world. We are in the best economy in the world, and we wait for stimulus checks, and we have all human comforts available to us. Why at this time, even though we worry for ourselves, is it so important not to lose sight of those internationally who are facing this pandemic in addition to their religious liberty violations?
It's something that we really need to pay more attention to. My view is that, you know, it's our brothers and sisters that we start with, but they're not the only ones. And we are very comfortable in America. I think our Christian communities live very well. I mean, we have certainly religious freedom problems here, or at least pushback. But it's more like discrimination than persecution. These people are suffering severe persecution. They're targeted. And particularly Nigeria. And by the way, the president of the United States has spoken to the president of Nigeria about this and not a thing was done. So he's part of the problem, not part of the solution. But we should pray for these people. When we know facts about this, we should communicate this to our churches. Ask for prayer, first of all, and then communicate to our congressmen. If we see something like this and get informed about it, we should ask America to speak up and do what we can, not just sit on our hands and say, oh, I hope I have enough toilet paper, but let's be concerned beyond our borders for those that have no voice in this world.
Leela, if you could wave a magic wand in the minute or two we have left here and you could direct the president to take one step internationally, what would it be?
I think I would speak up for Nigeria right now. I would ask him to speak again to President Buhari, and I would also seek an envoy or someone to go into Nigeria and specifically address the issue of this potential genocide that's going on there. I think that would be first on my list.
I think also we continue to pray, if we can, for Leah Sheribu. We remember she is one of the missing and disappeared Boko Haram girls. She has risen to some name recognition, but she remains out there, and her mother continues to pray for her, for her protection, for her continued safety. And we here at FRC continue to pray for her as well. Leela, what are we looking at going into the future? You've mentioned Nigeria as being the hottest of the hot spots. Are you seeing things pop up in other countries that we ought to be aware of?
Well, the surrounding countries in Africa, the movement of terrorists, there's something like 20 different terrorist groups, and I'm speaking much more broadly now, that are moving along the Sahel and West Africa and also in East Africa. Africa is a really hot zone right now for radical Islam, and that's a problem, and it's moving, and the Christians are the first to get attacked. So that's one place. Middle East is the Middle East. And we know that Iran is a huge problem, and that's another thing that we need to really pray that somehow the leadership is shifted there, because this is a terrible place for Christians.
Yes.
So those two are in my mind. And India also, you know, the Christians are now under the gun there because of some new Hindu legislations and so forth. So we have to get our eyes off ourselves sometimes and think about the rest of the world. I think it's important.
Oh, well said. Leela Gilbert, who is a visiting fellow at the Hudson Institute and FRC's Senior Fellow for International Religious Freedom, has been my guest. She is an expert on the developments of religious liberty and persecution around the world. She has written multiple books on the topic, and her books are available on Amazon. Just across the water from Sri Lanka, Indians, Christians are targeted for violent attacks in Nigeria, as we discussed, the Kurds in Syria, Africa facing its own dangers beyond Nigeria itself. But we at FRC continue to pray, even during the midst of a pandemic where we worry for ourselves. We pray for others whose very lives are at stake. Join us in praying for them, and we'll see you the next time we get together on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.